Well, good evening, everyone, and it's very nice to see you here. I've been informed by those sociologist colleagues of mine who do something called cultural studies that there is some major cultural event going on this evening, and I very much regret that us uncultured or non-cultured people, myself included, did not check out the World Cup schedule 9 months ago when we chose this date in consultation with our speaker, Professor Zhasnov, and fixed this event. The event will be just as significant to us with an intense and dedicated audience who you are. So I'm delighted to welcome you all to the annual lecture from the BIOS Center for the Study of Bioscience, Biomedicine, Biotechnology and Society. Wish I'd never chosen that long list of words. My name's Nicholas Rose and I'm the director of that center. And I'm absolutely delighted that for our annual lecture this year, we have one of the people who can truly claim to be founding mother, if I can put it like that, a founder of the whole enterprise of research and investigation and theorization that's come to be known as science and technology studies. Sheila Jasanoff is Pforzheimer Professor of Science and Technology Studies at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and also has an appointment at the Harvard School of Public Health. And she's also affiliated with the Department of the History of Science. And previously, she worked for many years at Cornell University, and she was the founding chair of Cornell's Department of Science and Technology Studies. What I didn't know before I started researching for my little introduction to this session was that Professor Jasanoff's first qualification was in maths from Harvard College, that she also holds a master's in linguistics from the University of Bonn, a doctorate in linguistics from Harvard, a JD from Harvard Law School, and she was admitted to the bar in Massachusetts in 1977 and actually worked from 76 to 78 with an environmental law firm in Boston. So she has a daunting span of disciplinary involvements. And for those of us who like to think that we are interdisciplinary, we mostly don't span from maths to linguistics to the social studies of science and technology and to law. I'm sure many of you will know that Sheila Jasanoff has had a very significant role within the development of sociology and social studies of science and technology in particular, served on many advisory panels in the United States, the U.S. National Science Foundation, the National Academy of Sciences, and the Institute of Medicine. She's also been engaged as a policy consultant with many organizations, including the OECD, the Office of Technology Assessment, the National Research Council, the National Science Foundation, and many others. And I think it's a real testament to the work that she's done that it doesn't just have such high value within the academic world, but it also constantly sought after within the policy world. As everyone here, I think, will know, her long-standing interest has been in the interrelationships between law, science, and politics, especially in democratic societies, and in particular on the role of law, and in particular recently on questions of regulation, risk, and risk management. And indeed, Sheila quite regularly comes here to the LSE, where she's involved in the activities of the Center for the Analysis of Risk and Regulation here at the LSE. She's the author of a daunting number of books, and I did actually print out her CV, but in deference to allowing her some time to give this talk, I won't read it out. But from Controlling Chemicals, the Politics of Regulation, published some 20 years ago, to the most recent book that many of us will have seen and been influenced by, which is a book called Designs on Nature, Science and Democracy in Europe and the United States, that was published by Princeton just this year, I think, or at the end of last year. And I know that that book and the argument within it has had very significant consequences, not just in general, but specifically for those who are working in our BIOS Center. So The title of Professor Jasanoff's lecture tonight is Experiments Without Borders, Biology in the Labs of Life. And I'm delighted to welcome her here to give the BIOS annual lecture.
Thank you very much, Nick, for that wonderful welcome, after which one is left more or less speechless. And the obvious way to come out of the speechless condition on tonight of all nights would be to make the appropriate reference to that cultural event that you described outside. And I really wish I had my daughter, you know, somehow tucked underneath the lectern, or our daughter, I should say, since my husband's in the audience, because she has been a football fan every 4 years ever since I started doing comparative research, and it was from her I learned that it wasn't just 1-0 the other day, but that the one was a particularly ignominious one for England because it was an own goal, as she explained to me from the other side of the Atlantic. So I wish that she had been able to deliver the segue joke instead of me. I will just have to, you know, continue as if we're here to celebrate BIOS, as we should be doing, and not whatever the England team is doing outside our borders. So you'll detect in the title, Experiments Without Borders, obviously a crypto reference to organizations like Doctors Without Borders and other ones that have formed themselves on that analogy. And I think that we're living in a time when a sort of founding premise of the way in which one should go about doing biotechnology has completely worn away. And this is the premise of containment. If you think back about 30 years ago when molecular biologists who were launching the era of biotechnology got worried about the potential consequences of their new science, and they got together at this conference center called Asilomar in California, they came up with a set of guidelines for how to do biotechnology safely, and the central conceptual move that they made at that meeting was to talk about containment. So if biotechnology got done with containment, then there was nothing to worry about at all. And what I want to suggest today is that that idea of containment from Asilomar has been blown out of the water. There's no such thing around anymore, that any sort of imagined distinction between an ivory tower science that can carry on under any kind of containment, whether it's physical containment, conceptual containment, moral and ethical containment, or political containment, that kind of idea simply doesn't hold. And yet many of our institutions for assessing the implications of biotechnology and how we receive biotechnology into our worlds are still premised on very old-fashioned ideas of the possibility of containment. So that's the kind of argument I want to develop for the rest of this evening. Now, when you stand at lecterns, it's often useful to have a text, as we know, from the dominant religion of this society, which also provided the background for my early schooling. And so I like to begin with text. And in this case, it's sort of useful to begin with none other than the Prince of Wales. And many of you are familiar with the fact that at a crucial time in the development of crop biotechnology, agricultural biotechnology, Prince Charles raised a set of 10 questions that were widely talked about, and they represented, as I've argued elsewhere, a kind of everyman talks back to biotechnology. It so happens that this everyman was the Prince of Wales. But the 10 questions got made much of, and the first 3 questions are relevant to the theses that I'm going to be developing later. So they were these questions that you see before you. And the 3rd one is the one that provides the specific jumping off point. Why are the rules for approving GM foods so much less stringent than those for new medicines produced using the same technology? Now, many people were a little reluctant to engage the prince directly, but not so Professor Derek Burke, who has been an ardent advocate of biotechnology and agricultural biotechnology in particular, and has frequently spoken out including at meetings where I've been with him in person, in favor of biotechnology. And when I saw his set of answers, one in particular, his answer to the prince's third question leapt out at me. So as he says, it's clear why, you know, we have different systems of assessment for medicines and food. And the point is that the rules are not less stringent, they're different, and the same as used elsewhere in the world. So there's universal harmonization around this idea. And then this last sentence, it's not the case that there has been no clinical trial of agricultural biotechnology, because after all, if you really want to start trials in humans, 300 million Americans have been eating GM soya for several years now without any ill effects. Well, I think the 300 million number was crossed after he said this, and there are babies who don't eat soy and so on and so forth, but even if you correct for the numbers, you know, it's obviously a fairly high number. Some of you may be familiar with the American poll results that show, by the way, that only 25% of those polled think that they're eating any GM products at all. So if Professor Burke is right, then certainly three quarters of the American adult population has no idea that it's been involved in this clinical trial for this number of years. So it made me begin to think, I mean, since I was part of the 3 million Americans, how did I feel about the notion that I had been unwittingly involved in this clinical trial so that Britain can safely launch into the development of GM crops, you know, on the basis of our experience, because after all, that's what Burke is arguing. You know, if you are in the field of science and technology studies, of course, you think about the forms of science. You know, how does science get its authority? Through what kinds of procedures? What's special about scientific authority? And the experiment or the trial is, of course, a centerpiece of the doing of science. And it turns out that not everybody shares Derek Burke's sanguine attitude to the idea of being involved in an experiment at all. And so this is just an example of a random or not so random poster created by the Pure Food organization suggesting that food is an area where we should be reluctant to engage in experimentation. So, you know, clearly there's not a sort of public consensus that this kind of clinical trial was an authorized thing or even is a good and desirable thing. So let's think about experiments and what we know about experiments from having done, you know, baby science, learned that experiments are at the heart of the scientific method, and also bringing to bear some of the things that we've learned from the systematic social study of science and technology over all these years. So first of all, to borrow a little bit from Thomas Kuhn's idea of normal science, one can imagine that normal experiments are part of the wherewithal, the machinery of normal science. And just as normal science happens within paradigms, so the experiments that are part of normal science happen within those paradigms. And those paradigms, that is, conceptual structures, theoretical frameworks that tell you, you know, how to do your science, provide the questions. You know, how do you know what's an interesting question, after all, in a scientific field? They establish methods by which you carry out your activities. And very importantly, those paradigms also provide the interpretive rules by which you're going to interpret the results of the experiments that you carry out. And one of the first early findings of the sociology of scientific knowledge was that in the absence of that kind of paradigmatic agreement about how to interpret experimental results, you get infinite deconstruction of the results. People go back and back and back and question every piece of your experimental design. And that was called experimenter's regress. And without the paradigmatic envelope, the containment, if you will, around the experiment, that's the kind of unpacking that you always get. Normal experiments, moreover, in the arena of biotechnology, get carried out under both physical and biological constraints. This is the idea of containment that I mentioned before, and both the lab and the field in which trials are done are areas of containment in that sense. And not least important is that normal experiments today get done under a variety of ethical constraints as well. For instance, if you are going to use animals in research, you have to abide by certain kinds of conditions, all the more so if you're going to use people in research. So informed consent has become an absolute sine qua non. If I have an undergraduate, as I do in any given summer, who's going off to do a research project somewhere else in the world, I currently have one in Chile and one in China, they have to get permission from Harvard's Human Subjects Research Committee before they can go and lay the most simple-minded questionnaire in front of the people that they're going to talk to in these other countries. And this is for undergraduate research projects that, you know, there's a limit to how intrusive they are and so on and so forth. And then, of course, there are also categories of banned experiments. We don't talk about them under that name, but, for instance, you know, there are certain kinds of experiments to test, for instance, the efficacy of a bioterror agent that you would probably have considerable difficulty getting past a university IRB, though you might be able to do it in a military lab. By contrast, the kinds of experiments that we find around biotechnology today, the ones that I'm calling experiments without borders, violate most of these constraints and most of these containing conditions. So first of all, the experimental sites themselves are unbounded. The experiments don't come out of any clearly given conceptual structure or scientific theoretical paradigm. Physical containment is almost an impossibility. A very important point is that a lot of the effects of working with biology move on through the generations, so there's not temporal containment either. You don't know instantly after you've done an experiment what the result is. It's not self-contained in that sense. It goes on through time. Another respect in which these experiments are without borders is that many of the things that we're producing through our capacity to manipulate genetic materials and other biological entities, many of those products sit uneasily among the conceptual categories that we have. So, for instance, what is a surrogate mother? I mean, you may think that this is a self-evident point, but why is the surrogate mother actually called a mother when she is, under most nations' laws, denied the basic rights of motherhood? I mean, you know, what is that entity that we've created there? What is a clone? What's a designer baby that's brought into being with certain preordained characteristics in mind? And what indeed are transgenic animals? I mean, when you name something a geep, you know, what is that thing? It's a cross between a goat and a sheep, we know that. But it crosses across the kinds of categories in which we've learned to think about the political world and the regulatory world. Not insignificantly as well, the products of biotechnology cross over political lines. I mean, so when a coalition of American and European researchers and funding agencies produce an entity called Golden Rice that's going to be engineered so as to become a vehicle for vitamin A production in the body, but it's being designed for potential eaters in Africa and Asia, the product is originating in one place, the users and the consumers, the potential recipients, are somewhere else. And of course, you're all familiar with the fact that much medical experimentation, clinical trials today, in fact, get done across national boundaries. When I began my research career, as Nick reminded us, you know, more than 20 years ago by now, it was a truism in the American chemical regulatory community that clinical trials on people could be done more easily in Europe, whereas animal testing could be done more easily in America, and multinational companies were actually dividing their testing strategies so as to take advantage of those differences in forums. Well, I mean, in those kinds of the sort of ethical implications of that sort of division are now much more clearly on the table in connection with the sorts of uncharted experiments that I'm talking about. And of course, that leads us into territory that is morally unmapped, either through ethical guidelines or you know, at the stronger level through law and public policy. So I want to give you, first of all, a couple of, you know, just sort of reminder images to suggest that one way or another, we're trying in various inchoate ways, imprecise, non-formalized ways, to deal with this borderlessness of the grand experiment of biological manipulation. This, of course, is a picture of Dolly, not at the moment of her birth, but at the moment of her public unveiling, which came 7 months later in Nature magazine, and this was the cover picture. And it's interesting that although Dolly was a first of kind, an animal produced by cloning from the cell of an adult mammal and not from embryonic materials, nevertheless, nobody raised questions about the ontology of Dolly. I mean, what kind of entity was Dolly? Now, my suspicion is that various kinds of insecurities bubbled away under the surface, and I think that this is a picture that somehow illustrates that the uneasiness was there and people felt it necessary to conquer the uneasiness. This is a picture from the New York Times a couple of years after the first announcement of Dolly's birth, April 1999. And the caption there says, "Dolly, who made news in 1997 as the first clone of an adult animal, reappeared last week with her newborn lambs in Scotland. They were conceived the old-fashioned way with help from a ram named David." So, you know, this sort of alien being has now been normalized by being brought into ordinary reproductive cycles, the old-fashioned way as opposed to the newfangled, you know, manner of her own creation. She's able to have children, which is a way of, you know, representing her normality in a sense, and a ram named David. I mean, even the resort to naming there, you know, is a sort of reassuring device, and I think the story says something about the sort of anxieties about Dolly that were not expressed overtly at the time of her creation. And of course, those anxieties lasted, you know, throughout her life and into the period, I mean, into when she died, because Dolly died too early by the standard lifespan of a sheep, and, you know, that's contributed to people's uncertainties about whether cloning should be allowed to happen and to what extent, and so on and so forth. The next pairing of images is an example of a place where I think the insecurities and uncertainties have not been very well contained as yet. I'm showing you here a picture of taken from the New York Times, as you see, just last October. And in a way, you can see it as a very political scientific experiment, a political scientific experiment in two senses. One, that it responds very specifically to the politics of the present American administration as spearheaded and articulated by George Bush. But secondly, also that it tries to deal with a sort of foundationally unsettled question of American politics around abortion and the morality of abortion, and it tries to do this with science. So George Bush, as again many of you will know, has said in supporting his rather restrictive policy, his administration's rather restrictive policy on stem cell research, that he will not promote science which destroys life in order to save life. And that's a trope that he uses a lot of the time. It's very interesting that he is, with that sentence, in a way undercutting what the Supreme Court has said about life, because the Supreme Court has refused to agree as yet that life begins at the moment of conception. Instead, they have dealt with abortion as a matter of women's rights being absolute for some period following following conception. So when George Bush is saying that the life of the fetus and the life of the person who's going to be saved through possible therapeutic cloning are equivalent, then he is in a way doing an end run around the Supreme Court's refusal to say that life begins at that moment of conception. I mean, that is a matter of, you know, sort of American constitutional politics that's helpful to remember. Well, it's a very American solution to try to get around those kinds of, you know, intransigent political problems by creating the technological fix. And in this case, the technological fix that people have tried to create is a stem cell extraction procedure which will not destroy life in order to create life. And this diagram in the New York Times illustrates how one cell can be removed from the blastomere without interfering with its capacity to develop further. So the life begins at conception, people get their fetal development trajectory, and the stem cell research people get their stem cells. And by doing this sort of highly technical manipulation contained within science, supervised by scientists, you've managed to take one of the most intransigent fights that Americans have had in politics over the last 30 years and corral it within science. Now, I don't think that that strategy is actually working. And one way that you see that the anxieties remain is that, you know, sort of everywhere you turn, you get images of people's responses to the idea of cloning, that, you know, cloning is something that is outside the lab. No matter what scientists do to try to contain this, you are going to get, you know, a sort of uncontrolled move of this technology into domains that are not going to be containable. And one reason I choose this picture is that it appears on the front cover of Francis Fukuyama's book, in which he argues for the regulation of biotechnology. But I found it, you know, just by chance in a French newspaper back in January of this year, which was reporting on Dr. Huang's misdeeds in Korea. I mean, so just this particular image, which of course itself has a history, it's distributed by Getty Images, which controls a great many popular images that you know, govern the ways in which we think about a lot of things. In any case, I mean, this particular image has a kind of, you know, global transmission suggesting that no matter what scientists and medical authorities are trying to say about how we will be able to control the process of cloning, there is enormous popular mistrust and skepticism about our capacity as societies to do this kind of thing. Well, I want to turn next to the fact that there are various mechanisms in law and public policy for trying to carry out containment, and I want to run quickly through some of those and then suggest that as far as people are concerned, publics are concerned, those methods of formal official containment are inadequate for reasons that I'll suggest. So the very first one that, again, many people by now are familiar with is an attempt to lay down ethical guidelines that will provide at least an after-the-fact justification for which kinds of experiments we're allowed to conduct and why. But bioethics has proved to be problematic in a number of ways. It can be politicized, and the American history of the presidential bioethics commissions illustrates this in detail, and if we have time, I'd be happy to provide details. But more to the point, from an academic angle, creating these bioethics bodies shoves certain kinds of questions under the carpet that ideally ought to be deliberated elsewhere in a democratic society. So what is it that we mean by ethical in the first place? When you set up a national bioethics commission, you don't ask anybody, well, what do you think ethical means? And yet most countries whose bioethics systems I've looked at have very idiosyncratic rules for deciding who even sits on these commissions. You know, what cluster of people? Do you have laypersons represented? Do you have only trained moral philosophers? Do you have representatives of industry? Do you have people representing the major religious groups? And if so, which ones? All of these kinds of questions, you know, the answers to them vary dramatically, even across Western Europe and North America. So what is ethical and what's bioethics is by no means you know, something on which there's universal agreement, it's almost the end product of the process rather than the starting point of the process. What issues will be considered? For instance, in America, there has been quite firm opposition to the idea that patenting involves any ethical choice. People say patenting is merely a technical application of well-ordered rules to a very technical area. There are no ethical issues involved here. European law feels differently about it, and global public opinion feels differently about it. Who participates, you know, who can engage in debates with bioethics bodies, and how? Completely unsettled. And how these bioethics bodies relate to policymaking institutions is also far from clear. I mean, it happens, I mean, their role varies from absolutely no influence to quite a lot of influence. And in Britain, for example, the initial response of government when people said, when scientists and others said, we really ought to have a national bioethics body similar to the one that Mitterrand created for France, Thatcher's response was, if you want to have it, you will not have it within government. And so the Nuffield Council's bioethics entity was formed, but as a self-consciously private body sitting outside of government. Well, obviously, the policy implications of having a privatized bioethics body, you know, allow a lot of exercise room for the imagination. Law is another way in which we try to put some kinds of boundaries around these experiments without borders that I'm talking about, but the law operates according to its own internal systemic concerns and considerations, which are very selective about those things that they choose to contain and those things that they don't. And I want to give you an example of a case that has been considered in both American and Canadian patent law and just indicate how radically different the two settlements are and what they imply about public debate and morality. So in 1980, the US Supreme Court issued what is surely one of the most important legal decisions governing biotechnology of all time. This was Diamond versus Chakrabarty. The question before the court was, is a life form patentable? And the case involved a microorganism. But the court decided the case using very broad language and said that patents can be granted for anything under the sun that is made by man. Well, anything under the sun is very broad language, yes, and it's been very broadly interpreted, and 7 years later the US Patent Office issued a patent on an oyster, and 8 years later it issued a patent on a mouse. And since then it's issued patents on all kinds of mammals as well. Nobody in America asked what made by man means. It was simply taken for granted that made by man means some human intervention was involved, and the thing in question did not pre-exist that human intervention. So in those, you know, thinking in that way, the Supreme Court and other courts in the country have held that if you manipulate a single gene in a species of corn, what you get is something made by man. And similarly, when you manipulate a single gene in a mouse, what you get at the end of that process is something made by man. And so there's no difference in hierarchy, as far as the patent law is concerned, between patenting a bacterium and patenting higher animals, including a mouse. My university was provided the test case for showing how that conceptual leap happens. And this famous thing called the Harvard mouse or the Harvard oncomouse was manipulated to be sensitive to breast cancer so that it could be used as a test animal for various kinds of cancer therapeutic research. And the mouse itself was seen as nothing more than, you know, in a sense, a container for this oncogene, so that because it was just the delivery vehicle for this oncogene, you know, it could be patented. And the fact that the mouse had any kind of traits or potential variability in relation to other mice or generational capabilities, all of this stuff was unimportant from the standpoint of US law. Simply by virtue of having gone in there and inserted the oncogene, the people who created this mouse had taken something that was in nature and made it something in culture and hence patentable. But 22 years later, the Canadian Supreme Court was asked to decide whether the Harvard mouse was patentable or not. It had been patented, as I say, with no further discussion beyond the 1980 Diamond versus Chakrabarty case in America. But the Canadian court reached the opposite decision, and they said, no, it is not patentable. Of course, the process is patentable. The dissent in the Canadian case used this lovely term, murine metaphysics, and took their brethren to task for having engaged in what they said was mouse metaphysics. But the metaphysics are interesting because they bear on this question of experiments and how far they can go. And the majority justices said that the same mouse would exist absent the injection of the oncogene into the fertilized egg cell. And you see how this is a radically different reading from what the American judicial and patent system has read this as. That for the Americans, the insertion of the gene makes it a radically different thing, something that never existed. For the Canadian court, the same mouse would have existed, you know, even in the absence of the oncogene. It simply would not be predisposed to cancer. So, you know, this is a little bit of comparative law to suggest that it's unclear. I mean, even in a field that is as dedicated to the consistency of application of principle, you really cannot predict, you know, which way legal decisions will come out and what reasoning they're going to take. And it's from the standpoint of, you know, people wanting deliberative democracy, it's a rather disturbing thing to see, you know, two North American countries interpreting the same law. They have, it's the same English language and the same legal text, but reaching such radically different kinds of solutions. Because, you know, judiciaries, when all is said and done, are not political bodies, they're not accountable. So this kind of radical differentiation is a thing for us to ponder about. Well, I've been talking about formal methods of dissent, and it's important to realize that as these biotech experiments have crossed borders and left the lab and escaped the bottle as if they are genies, so the dissent and the public debate around biotech has also proved to be borderless or transborder in various senses. And I'll just very quickly run through a bunch of different ways in which people are expressing critical commentaries or providing critical commentaries on what is happening inside the lab, but these are all informal mechanisms and they have pros and cons, and we'll finish up talking a little bit about those. So first of all, scientists themselves remain each other's most powerful peer critics in a sense, and so expert criticism can arise from areas that were not involved in the original experiment. In addition, if people are experimenting with our lifestyles, as for instance GM soya for 300 million Americans, people can choose to adopt alternative lifestyles in which they take themselves out of the experimental world, as it were. People can offer resistance, and I see back there Martin Bauer, who's talked a lot about resistance to new technologies in his work here at the LSE, and George Gaskell as well, who's talked about mobilization and public participation. People can mobilize, people can engage in symbolic politics, and people can completely leave the policy world and express their critique through other discursive avenues, such as art. And I'll give little examples of each of these. So in terms of expert criticism, one of the very powerful criticisms against agricultural biotechnology came from an experiment that was conducted actually at my previous university, Cornell, and it involved the monarch butterfly, which is a sort of iconic species that created a lot of excitement in America because people are very fond of that particular butterfly, and the experiment questioned the limits of the original safety assessments that had been done on bioengineered corn that had insecticide genes built in. Because it turned out that in this study, the researcher fed the larvae of monarch butterflies on their favorite crop, namely milkweed, which had been dusted with pollen from the genetically modified corn, and about half the larvae died. Now, this was not a sort of weak signal, it was a quite strong signal, and Monsanto, the manufacturer of that corn, spent quite a number of years then trying to explain why it was that Losey's experiment at Cornell was not a good knockdown of their argument that the product was safe. But it's interesting that this debate only began after an independent researcher chose to undertake this study in the first place. And interestingly as well, Monsanto offered an argument suspiciously like Derek Burke's, that we've put all this out into the field and there are not 300 million Americans, but all these Americans and all these monarch butterflies, and they haven't died yet. But, you know, it was a sort of post hoc argument then, as in Burke's case. In terms of alternative lifestyles, well, Ben and Jerry's has made the transition to this country as of a number of years ago. I still remember the naming campaign that resulted in Cool Britannia, Ben and Jerry's brand never before heard of, that included strawberries and broken bits of shortbread to appeal to British tastes. But of course, in America, they were long since known as a politically, socially conscious company that was, for example, donating a percentage of its earnings to social causes from very early on. Well, they were at one time a small company based in Vermont, and they didn't want to use genetically modified bovine growth hormone. And when they said that they wanted to advertise on their products that they didn't want RBGH, as it was called, the Food and Drug Administration came down hard on them and said, we have found, the Food and Drug Administration, no difference between bovine growth hormone from, I mean, the natural product and the genetically engineered product. If you put a label on your ice creams saying, we have no RBGH in our products, in effect, you're scaring the public by making an artificial distinction through your advertising. So you may not do this, or we will get you under false advertising laws. So instead, Ben & Jerry's produces a political statement, and after considerable legal wrangling with FDA, they came up with a label. And so the label says not that the product contains no RBGH, but that they get their milk from farmers who pledge not to treat their cows with RBGH. And of course, as a cautionary note, they also have to add that the FDA has said no significant difference has been shown and no test can distinguish between these two kinds of milk, and not all the suppliers of our other ingredients can promise, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, you know, you see here a product of American legal ingenuity, but you see that it's actually difficult to carve out an alternative lifestyle once a technology becomes as embedded, ingrained, and permeated as agricultural biotechnology has. I have absolutely no basis for making the next comment I'm going to make, but I do think this, that British politics produces more pictures that I think British politics happens in the visual domain. I mean, maybe it's the theatrical tradition, maybe it's the absence of as many formal procedures as we have so that people feel that they need to resort to theater. But over many years of comparative political study, I have discovered that some of the best pictures to show what's going on in the public domain are produced here. And in this case, this was a Greenpeace organized destruction. I mean, so this is a form of resistance at its most basic, a destruction of a research plot planted with genetically modified crops. And when I talked to the people who were organizing these campaigns, they said it's incredibly effective to have a Bobby in the background. So, you know, it was a piece of theater, rhetoric, et cetera, et cetera. A somewhat different sort of resistance, which actually worked very well, happened around the Terminator gene, which was the popular name given to Monsanto's projected, I mean, not even yet undertaken, research strategy that was going to include a gene in various grains that would shut off fertility in the next generation down. So this would prevent farmers from hoarding their seed or saving their seed from one year to the next. And this resulted in a really serious public outcry, in effect, you can look at that case as a case of global popular technology assessment, people saying, sorry, we just don't want that technology. And they were able to form a coalition with powerful actors such as the Rockefeller Foundation. And ultimately, it was that coalition that brought pressure to bear on Monsanto. And they retreated, at least for then, away from that technological trajectory. Symbolic politics, well, you see there the transparent Norman Foster dome of the Reichstag in Germany, in Berlin. But these sorts of images, you know, starting with the WTO protests in Seattle, there have been lots and lots of global protests in which people use the various symbols of globalization and biotechnology to build up a kind of public support, a nonverbal discourse of opposition against these technologies. And then this one, which I think is worth our stopping and thinking about, a Chicago-based American artist who a number of years ago created, or said he had created, it's not absolutely clear, this rabbit, which was genetically modified with jellyfish genes so that it glows when you expose it to ultraviolet light, and it was named Alba. And I still remember when the news of Alba's birth, unlike the news of Dolly, was first made public, scientist colleagues of mine said, you know, this is an absolute disaster. People shouldn't be doing this. This is irresponsible. It's an unethical experiment. One of my colleagues, the head of the Science, Technology, and Public Policy program then at the Kennedy School, said that this has absolutely no utility for people. But since then, you know, in the context of experimentation, deliberation, and who has a right to speak about these things, I've been wondering whether we might not read this artistic experiment in somewhat other ways. So Alba does a certain number of things that Dolly did not do. And I think for those of us who like the comparative method, it's worth putting Alba, the glowing bunny, next to Dolly, the cloned sheep, and ask what things does Alba perform that Dolly did not. So first of all, just the visibility-invisibility issue. Dolly looked the same as any other sheep, whereas Alba, at least when put under the right kind of light, reveals herself as a new kind of thing. And it calls attention to the fact that biotech is constantly producing for us new kinds of things that we haven't dealt with before. Because Alba is a plaything created as an obvious fetish, I mean, in fact, the creator wanted to bring the animal into his house as a pet, but supposedly he had to do the research in France, and American import authorities or border authorities wouldn't allow him to bring the animal back into Chicago, or at least this is the story that was given out. But it shows, you know, makes visible the constructedness of the things that we do with biotechnology. It places subliminally on the table a question about the purposes of genetic manipulation. Why are we doing this? To what ends? And this is a question that people in bios and people in demos, for instance, also present in this audience, have been asking a lot in connection with novel technologies. And important to me, it puts on the table the question of the meaning of new technologies for us and says that anybody can speak about the meaning of a new technology. When you move it out of science and into art, you suddenly allow, you know, a lot more talk about the thing that's going on. So are these informal mechanisms adequate for the kind of global and intense deliberation that I think should accompany a novel revolutionary series of suite of technologies, scientific discoveries, as in the life sciences arena? And I think the answer is clearly no. And very simply, all of these responses, strategies, reactions that I've talked about are constrained by the following factors. First of all, they're reactive. That is, they happen after somebody else has done something already. Very often, the nature of the debate is constrained by how the initial experiment was framed. So when people plant their symbols in front of the Bundestag, in front of the Reichstag, they're corn cobs. Why? Because corn cobs are the thing that got manipulated. I mean, so in that sense, even when people are engaging in symbolic politics, they have to be speaking back to something that has already happened. I couldn't think of a good phrase for this. I called it ontological enclosure. But what I mean is that people very often are not given a chance to debate seriously about the kinds of things that are being brought into existence. I mean, you know, BT corn has been accepted as something that we ought to have. But, of course, even the juxtaposition of the United States and Mexico suggests that Mexicans are less tolerant of the idea of BT corn than people in the United States are, or at least growers in the United States are. And yet, once that ontology is out there, out of its borders, you know, something that 300 million Americans are already eating, then other people are already sort of closed in by the ontological settlements that have been made elsewhere. Hand in hand with all of this goes the fact that the even if protest is successful, it usually results in a rejection of whatever the technology is, and the Terminator case is interesting from that point of view, not redesign. So if we believe that these technologies are important, that that human creativity ought to probe into the unknown, as the Supreme Court said in Diamond versus Chakrabarty, then we should be worried about procedures that allow for redesign, not just rejection. It just say no may be a good slogan for teenage drugs, but it's not a good slogan for biotechnology. The audiences reached by these various informal modes of debate and deliberation are highly selective. You know, who is actually going to pass by the Reichstag on the given day? And the ties to power and policy are even weaker than in the case of the bioethics commissions that I've already talked about. Well, so where do we go from here? And, you know, as usual, it's easier to look at what is and say something, you know, halfway sensible about what is working and what is not working. It's much harder to talk about how to redesign institutions that have been carefully designed over many years, many centuries even in some cases, to preclude the kinds of deliberation that I'm talking about. So bringing society back in, I've been arguing, is essential because these experiments are now occurring without borders, and therefore society is implicated from the very beginning. Some of you may know of an extraordinarily influential book by Ben Anderson in which he talked about nations as imagined communities, communities that imagine themselves to hang together, maybe because they've all hung the flag of St. George out of their windows for the same couple of weeks in the same every 4-year season. But with regard to technology, I think we almost have to turn that phrase around. That is, I think we have to learn to think of technologies themselves as imaginaries, as imagined systems or spaces, and communities of different sorts have to think about how to intervene in those imaginations and interject, you know, other sorts of ways of imagining things. So a term that has certainly gained enormous popularity on this side of the Atlantic is upstreaming. We're not really talking that way in America, but we're talking about things like real-time technology assessment, which is an idea that has some of those same qualities. What it means is post hoc reactive solutions are not enough, and we have to think about how to interject serious public critique and opinion much earlier on in the process of design. And what I'm arguing further is that this has to be done not just so people can express their values, you know, the yuck reaction against reproductive cloning. That's not so much the point. I'm trying to suggest that we are actually, with novel technologies, engaged in a continuous process of experimentation. And it's the design of those experiments, the concept, the conceptual structure, the premises, the hypotheses, the outcomes, how we evaluate them, all of that has to be on the line. And so this is very much a rational argument as well, not just an argument about letting people express, you know, some inchoate values so they can go home happy that they were heard at the end of the day. Further, most of the experiments that have been done with public engagement have tended to be very ad hoc, you know, a silver bullet, a jury, a referendum, a consensus panel, you know, various kinds of things. But if experimentation itself is an ongoing process, as I believe, when technologies go out into the world, then public engagement has to be much more continuously conceived as well. Most of the forums we have in which all of this kind of debating gets done, like think of GM Nation in this country, are very much national forums, organized, constituted, procedurally devised in accordance with the rules of particular nation states. And we really have to think about how to design forums without borders, to think about experiments without borders. And this is happening in an extremely patchy way at the present time. And then lastly, I want to leave with a question that many of the examples I've talked about actually come, examples of resistance and examples of reimagining come more from the agricultural biotechnology, the green biotechnology side of things. And yet when all is said and done, most of us in this room probably care more about how biology is going to affect human nature, you know, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, and with that societal nature. You see very sort of minor perturbations about all of this, like when people talk about genetic testing of fetuses and then sex selection based on those tests, and that's skewing populations in some parts of the world. Well, that's a very minor example of people getting worried about the sort of reimagination of human nature. And I think, to me, it's an interesting question why it is that around green biotechnology there has been so much more creative mobilization and attempt by publics to insert themselves into the imaginaries that are produced by science and industry, and in a way, in some ways, a less developed political discourse around the human. Is it that ethics has been too successful in too early corralling of the kind of deliberative talk that I would like to see there? And if so, I think we very much need an opening up of the whole notion of bioethics to permit a more inclusive and in some ways a more contentious debate than we've had on many of these issues thus far. So let me stop there.
Well, I'd like to thank Sheila very much for a very wide-ranging and incisive account of the problems that we face and some provocative solutions. I also share the view that much of the debate around these things has become rather defensive, and the possibilities of reimagining in a positive way what human nature might be are often constrained. We have about 20 minutes for questions. I was going to begin with the observation that maybe some on this side of the pond might wonder a little bit about the interpretation of the results of that experiment on 300 million Americans, and question whether or not there had been any adverse effect on the American population as a result of them eating GM food. But that would be a cheap remark. So I'll hand over to you for questions, with just a reminder for those people who don't know the old theatre, the acoustics are very bad, so if you could wait for one of the mobile mics to reach you, that would make everybody happy. And we'll start with one in the centre there and the one immediately behind. One, two, three. And then the gentleman in the blue jacket and then the lady in the white.
Before the discussion opens, in view of the great depth of your presentation and the absence of an audience appropriate to hear it, may I ask whether there is any intention to publish this lecture on the LSE website?
We would seek permission for that. I very much hope we'll be able to, or find some way at least of making it available to a wider audience. Yeah, they're on. If you prefer to sit, or you prefer to sit.
Would the speaker believe that experimentation with mitochondria might lengthen life, and have any comments on the ethical repercussions of lengthened life?
Well, lengthened life by itself is not considered a good by many people, and many of us increasingly are seeing greatly lengthened life on the part of our parents or grandparents, and thus far many of the other attributes that one would want with long life, like long health and long mobility and so on, are not coming into being. I'm not sure of the spirit in which you asked the question. I remember that about 30 years ago, Robert Sinsheimer, a very famous American biologist, created a huge stir in the biological community by saying that he thought that there ought to be some experiments that shouldn't be conducted. And one of them, he said, or certain lines of research, actually, one of them, he said, was aging. And, of course, this was, first of all, before the formation of the political groups around aging that happened, you know, later on in America. But it's clear that, I mean, the example you're raising is exactly the sort of thing that I'm talking about, that, you know, prolongation of life in sheer biological terms, the number of years you're adding to a person's life, happens inside a very complex social context. It's happening while many other changes are affecting the family, many other changes are affecting people's ability to work. So, for instance, in America, we don't have a retirement age. In most of Europe, you do have a retirement age. So prolonging life so that people are routinely living to 120 and the retirement age is at 65, and, you know, what are the implications of this for all kinds of things, including treasuries, not least of all. So to imagine that one could simply do research on aging or prolonging life without taking any of these other concerns on board and without finding out, well, what do people want? I mean, supposing people think that that amount of research money ought to be expended instead on other things, such as maybe malaria or maybe arthritis. I mean, you know, I don't know. We don't tend to have those relative priority discussions about research policy, really, nor do we have a forum. I mean, our peer review mechanisms around grant getting and grant giving don't line up different research trajectories side by side and say, do this, don't do that.
I believe life expectancy of a woman born in North America, white woman born in North America, is probably about 85 at birth. I believe life expectancy in Malawi is 39. There's a person there, yes, with the mic.
I'd be very interesting to hear your view on where exactly the boundary should be set between what the public should know and what should be held away from the public. Of course, it would be very democratic and very well for most of the information to be open to everybody. But on the other side, if we open everything that scientists do or research or are trying to find out, of course, there will be more competition in the field, even more. Some things that really probably shouldn't be open to everybody will emerge, and probably science will go a lot further than we might want it to. So where really should be this boundary?
Well, I think it's maybe useful to begin by observing that these kinds of questions never have you know, either or sorts of answers, that if we look at any kind of system of open information, what you find is that there are competing rules that are in place. So, for instance, universities are among the most open societies that we know. We all believe that knowledge should be transparent and totally available and so on and so forth. But, for instance, when a decision is being made to give somebody a permanent post, what we call tenure decisions in America, the letters written for or against the candidate may be held in the strictest confidence for a variety of reasons and are not made open. So I think if you look into any models of open information systems, you will find that it's never, you know, a sort of blanket transparency. There are always tacit rules under the, you know, or sometimes explicit rules for what things are being made available and what not. So my view is that where, I mean, my view is twofold. One is that there ought to be debate on what these rules are so that people are actually aware where the lines are being drawn between openness and not, and that in some areas the lines are clearly being drawn too much on the side of secrecy. So, for instance, genuine upstreaming on technological design choices today can't happen because of confidentiality claims by industry, and those confidentiality claims are permeating universities through privately funded research. So that's an area in which I think that the rules and presumptions badly need to be elevated and played out.
Okay, I've got another group of three, and then I'll take another group of three. So one gentleman at the back, and Sarah Franklin over there, and then I'll take the next three.
You mentioned a number of the constraints of sort of normal experiments that don't appear to be constrained in contemporary biotech concepts, geography, ontology, politics, and so on. One form of constraint you didn't mention was economics. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on whether market constraints if those sorts of constraints on science have remained constant, or whether economic boundaries have also dissipated, or whether perhaps sort of markets might be playing a more important role in determining what sort of issues are examined by biotech.
Yes, well, I should remember that it's the London School of Economics and Political Science, not Political Science and Economics, and that's a very important point you raise. I think that the economic constraints, of course, have changed. So, for instance, in most advanced industrial countries, the relative funding of science by government as opposed to the private sector is a constantly changing thing. And in the States in particular, private money has been flowing into biotechnology for quite a long time, and the share is increasing as well. And I think that what all of that implies is that whether the borders are disappearing or not is highly contingent on where you sit. So, for instance, it's not unheard of for a firm, a multinational company, in an industrial country to be able to do its research wherever it pleases, to round up raw materials, people for clinical trials, and so on and so forth. The reverse is not possible. So if you even take a semi-industrialized country like India, it's much more likely that Indians will be serving as clinical trial subjects than as the people doing clinical trials in America. I've never heard of that reverse thing being true. And those kinds of things are consequences of economic constraints operating very differently in different geographical parts of the world.
Okay, the gentleman with the blue shirt there.
Thanks. This actually, question actually picks up on what was said in the last question. But I mean, I really liked your point about the way that the debates around the biosciences have been, in a sense, corralled by ethics and this notion, this constrained notion of what ethics is. But I do wonder whether the talk of upstreaming, talk of deliberation, talk of democratization actually corrals the issues again in terms of politics and a particular conception of politics, which you know, which is in a sense the traditional bourgeois parliamentary conception of politics as external to economics. Because in a sense, when you think about what these technologies are. They're means of production. And the earlier gentleman mentioned the market, but that's not the only way in which these things are economic. They're also economic in the sense of the relations within the productive process, the labor process, the mode of production. And of course, those aspects of production have never been democratic in our society. Democracy sort of, in some ways, ends at the point of production, and managerial authority takes over. So in that sense, I would argue that really democratizing these issues about technology and the way we go about producing new life forms, producing new agricultural technologies, that poses a radical challenge to how we conceptualize the limits of democracy itself. So I just wondered what you would say to that.
Well, you've produced an extremely eloquent argument for continuing to think of democracy as an essentially contested concept whose meaning we have to keep asking about. Democratization, you know, can't mean simply creating a bunch of procedures and saying, you know, you can walk in off the street and make comments on the plans that we're making and so on and so forth. It turns out that even voting has become a rather bourgeois preoccupation, at least in the United States, that voter apathy is growing and growing, and the classes who vote are the ruling classes, the people with the highest income levels, the people with the highest educational levels, and women more than men. I mean, so, you know, the sort of standard instruments of democracy are not performing particularly well, and exactly what we mean by democracy isn't, I mean, you know, it's become attenuated. Lots of people talk about the hollowing out of democracy in our time. Lots of people talk about anomie. I mean, those things, I think, are right. And that's why I spent a lot of time talking about sort of extra formal ways of going about getting public engagement. I personally think that we need to think much more about the scale at which these debates happen. So, you know, localism in relation to globalism, I think we have to think about the ways in which institutions produce rather obvious barriers to democratization, like the World Trade Organization. I mean, you know, I think what I feel about this in part is, let's not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. I mean, we're never going to get perfect democratization. There are lots and lots of things where even the sort of minimal preconditions that we might all agree on are not being met. And so a sort of selective analysis of very powerful institutions asking, you know, sort of very plain Jane questions about, you know, who really gets to see what, how closely held are decisions, and so on and so forth, accompanied by a set of debates between partners who aren't usually sitting at the same tables. There are not many forums in American politics where a developing country person can speak directly to a member of the Bush administration and raise these questions about means of production and so on and so forth, and nor indeed about discrepant ethical standards, discrepant property rights systems, and so on and so forth. So I think we can think a lot about institutional reforms that would get us to points that are better than what we have now, and where there would be quite a lot of agreement that they're better than what we have now.
Sarah.
Oh, thanks. That was a great lecture. I really appreciated that. And I could make the question really short if I just said Tesco. But the longer version would be, is there a more everyday kind of resistance to the over-industrialization of the food chain and all of its linked effects from global warming to child health that does offer a model of a kind of communal reimagining? Or are you a bit pessimistic about that? And I wondered if you could just say a little bit about how that quite widespread movement to express views about everything from agricultural biology to child health has come to be an ordinary part of going to the supermarket.
Was that itself a sort of optimistic observation? I'm not sure I see it as an across the board happening. I mean, I do think that communal reimaginings are happening in selective ways around particular sorts of things. And to some extent, it's most live where new communities are forming around those imaginings. I mean, so for instance, indigenous people around property rights and genetic products. I mean, the indigenous people's groups themselves didn't even exist as groups until they felt this threat to their property rights being infringed upon, and now you're seeing a sort of co-evolution of the emergence of these groups and a set of, you know, quite everyday critical discourses about, you know, how sort of Anglo-Saxon conceptions of property rights are not adequate to safeguard what these people would want, or around climate change, the emergence of something like the small island nations as a political force, which, you know, in no other way could they possibly have been unless they had been able to find within the phenomenon of climate change resources to imagine themselves as a community that didn't exist before. So I think, and you know, the kind of thing that Paul Rabineau talks about under the heading of biosociality, that the emergence of new genetic traits has allowed people to imagine themselves as part of new social groupings with, you know, with the ability to set agendas and push policy forward in certain kinds of directions. I guess I'm worried about the adequacy of that, especially in the light of the previous question. That is, if it is the case that communal reimaginings are happening where communities already have sufficient resources to respond to certain kinds of perceived or actual threats and form themselves into these kinds of coalitions, what about all those other cases where people lack those resources, where you know, they are definitely implicated and could think of themselves in communal terms, but various attributes are missing so that they don't. I think that as sort of, I don't know, counterexamples, one could think of rhetorics like environmental justice, for instance, that have broken through those sorts of barriers of economic and class position to some extent. And the sort of extension of ideas of environmental justice now to domains that are not just environmental. So, you know, one could come up with some of those examples, but I don't see as yet, without a push from law and public policy, opportunities where people not already well endowed with the capacity to regroup themselves will get into these debates and be able to engage in the imaginings.
Okay, let me take three more questions, which I saw before. Jack Price, and then George Black.
I was just wondering why you'd constrained your comments to biotechnology. It seems to me everything you say applies to technology more broadly. So the experiments without borders that you're describing, that applies to every technology that's been introduced, all the major technologies that have been introduced over the last 100 or 200 years. I mean, none of us had any say about whether television would invade our lives. Over the last 30 years, we've had no say of whether computers would invade our lives. And the parameters that you're concerned about are much more influenced by conventional technologies than biotechnologies. So, for example, the gentleman earlier who asked you about mitochondrial the impact of mitochondrial technologies on lifespan. The biggest impact on lifespan over the last 100 years has been in hygiene and plumbing. Right? Would you have applied such restrictions to those because of the impact they were going to have on us? So I'm slightly concerned of how you're going to implement the kind of distinctions that you're drawing in a way that will be meaningful and not actually have an overly great impact on life sciences. You could make a very strong case, I think, for saying that biotechnology, life sciences generally, are the most regulated aspect of technology already, and that actually within the relatively minor impact that they are having, they're over-regulated, and that it's the other technologies that impact on us much more directly and much more quickly, I would say, that you should be turning your attention to.
Well, I mean, obviously far too important questions to be dealt with in a short answer. But I think, first of all, you're right that the argument is not only about the life sciences, though launching a BIOS annual lecture series, you know, one does want to focus in on the particular examples to do with the life sciences. I do think there are some special things about the life sciences. On a theoretical level, I do think all kinds of technological developments can be thought of in ontology-changing terms, but the line is more far-fetched than in the context of especially human biology, but also agricultural biology. And I think that the sort of reflexive properties of the life sciences, their ability to bear back on ways in which we think about ourselves as a human species, that's, you know, television doesn't, you know, do that with quite the same urgency. Of course it does. I mean, that is, if you think of the television as people in science and technology studies do, as, you know, almost like a human actor in a network of human relationships, and it, of course, brings human beings that would not be in your living room into your living room in all kinds of ways. I mean, yes, you could think about it in that way, but, you know, it's a fact about all sameness-difference arguments that we could do the sameness difference shtick till we're blue in the face. The more important thing to realize is that, you know, some differences matter in certain ways. Like if you get two historians together, they will always say, oh, this is new. Oh, are you sure that's new? And, you know, that's not really new. And yet things change. And, you know, so I think there's that kind of possible debate about the life sciences. On the regulation point, I want to make clear that I'm not saying there should be more regulation. I'm saying that we have here a profoundly important technology which affects our ability to imagine or reimagine all kinds of aspects of our lives as societies and living together. And I think that that capacity to imagine is too closely held at the moment, with possible risks, but I'm not so much worried about risks in the physical or environmental sense even, although I do think that those concerns were under-considered at the time that America released vast quantities of genetically modified crops into the biological environment. But I think the question of, you know, technological societies and how they interact, I mean, you know, in part the sponsors of this meeting come from the sociology department, and it's been recognized now for a while that a sociology that doesn't think about technology as being part of sociology is an impoverished sociology. So how do we rethink that? It doesn't mean necessarily regulation. I mean, regulation may be far too narrow a response to this wider question of how do we repoliticize, re-philosophize the territory of living with our own technologies.
Okay, I think I'm going to take the last two questions, and then we'll probably be pressing on our time. So James Wilsden and then George Gaskell at the back.
Sheila, thank you for a brilliant lecture. You opened with a reference to a cinema, and I just wondered if you had any reflections to offer on the attempt last month to recreate an a cinema moment when this group of synthetic biologists met in California and tried to come up with this framework for self-regulation in synthetic biology. And I just wondered really whether you felt depressed that elements within the scientific community still felt that such gestures of containment, of self-regulation were possible, or whether you felt heartened that they were at least trying. And I asked the question in a week when this stuff's been quite high profile here in the UK. We had the Guardian newspaper obtaining these different segments of DNA that could be combined into a potentially lethal virus. So this stuff is sort of bubbling up. I was just interested whether you felt that the synthetic biology debate was a particularly interesting emerging case study.
Do you want me to?
Let's take the two of them,
okay.
And then you can use that for your closing remarks, George.
Yeah, it's going to be tricky to combine synthetic biology with my question. Sheila, you talked about various informal mechanisms of resistance, and you asked the question, are these sufficient? And your answer was no. And I just wondered whether it's a kind of glass half full or half empty. Because if we think back, at least to Europe, in 1998, a moratorium is introduced on GM crops. It stays in existence until 2003, 2004, and it's only lifted because the World Trade Organization rules against Europe. Another consequence of those informal methods of resistance was the introduction of labeling, which was rejected by all the industry and most government and regulators as quite unnecessary, etc., etc. So I would think, I'm not arguing against you on other mechanisms, but I think one should recognize the power of civil society in the public domain to have quite an impact on the course of development, the trajectory of a technology.
Well, just quick comments on both. James, I haven't actually been following the synthetic biology thing. I mean, I've known, you know, at the side of my radar screen that it's happening, so I'm not yet depressed. But on science and self-regulation, I mean, I have no problems with any professional or technical group attempting to devise its own ideas of responsibility, but they should operate with a more reflexive sense of what it is they can assume. So what depresses me about Ursula Lamar moments is the continuing mythology that this was the most successful attempt at self-regulation, which of course does not take into account that the moment also successfully framed, especially in the US context, biotechnology as being a very precise molecular biology driven enterprise that was had very little to do with society, certainly not much to do with the environment, and precision, knowability, those were the themes that gained prominence at that time. So my question in looking at the synthetic biology thing would be to ask, did they have a different set of participants? And I think they didn't very much, or certainly not the sort of people who recognize these moments as being important framing moments and can therefore bring, you know, that sort of critique to bear. And if not, then, you know, how can one enlarge that discussion? Because it surely will need to be enlarged and right soon as well. And George, on your point, I mean, which is also a sort of optimism, pessimism point, half full or half empty, I wouldn't have bothered running through all of those informal mechanisms if I didn't think they were important. They obviously are important. But maybe here a little bit my bias as a lawyer is also showing through. I mean, I think that it's fine to have informal mechanisms in a bubbling up phase, but that eventually you do need some kind of more formal structures to make the sorts of places at the table that people are asking for, specific moments of intervention, specific rights, even in some cases, to actualize them. It isn't everybody who can participate in those sorts of things. I mean, you know, it takes resources and sometimes formal systems are able to decrease or lower the barriers for people who have the least amount of resources. So it's not, I mean, it's an ongoing sort of evolution. I do think that popular responses by their nature end up being reactive because there's got to be something you actually see that's happening. The Terminator case was maybe one of the best examples of a case where popular resistance got going at the very idea of something in the works that was not already in the works. And that's why I ask whether that model is too contingent to be generalized. But we should reflect on those things and think about how, you know, supposing it hadn't been Gordon Conway at the head of the Rockefeller Foundation at that moment, but somebody more intransigent. Supposing it hadn't been Robert Shapiro, head of Monsanto. You don't want these sorts of things to depend on individual people who maybe see better or have more sympathy. I mean, that's where law and policy need to come into play. But, you know, maybe we're having a cultural discussion between me, the American formalist, and you, the British scholar who lives in a culture of muddling through.
Well, that seems a very appropriate moment to end. Just before asking you to thank Sheila. I know that there are some people who wanted to ask questions. I apologize for not giving you that opportunity, but there is a reception in the senior common room on the fifth floor if you would like to join us for a more informal chat. I would like to also say that we'll do our best to make this lecture available to as wide a possible audience, and I'll talk with Sheila about that afterwards. And just in conclusion, I will say one thing. Amongst the many things I forgot to say about Sheila was, of course, she has trained a whole generation of graduate students whose work is now having a very, very significant effect, in addition to her own work, across this whole field that we've been discussing. And I think tonight we've seen some of the reasons why they're doing such terrific work in their mentor. So thank you so much for a terrific lecture, Sheila.